FM.
Stay relevant and up to date. Keep you informed. This is 101.9 High FM.
You're listening to 101.9 High FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. Welcome to the program. Nice to be joining you on this slightly fresh Monday morning. You can tell Sukkot is coming because it's raining, right? Sukkot is on its way, and it was raining. We had an excellent downpour last night, and I hope it does continue because we do need all the rain that we could get. And I hope that you did have a great Yom Kippur and you didn't eat too much and that it was very fulfilling and very nice. And on the New Blue Review, as usual, this is your current affairs and culture program on Chai FM. And a few weeks ago, I was busy doing the news. I was doing the morning show with Zanati, and she said, you know, she's very excited because there's this new show coming out called King Kong. And I thought, you know, I just assumed it was something to do with gorillas. And she said, no, it's actually this amazing play about a boxer and whatever. And she said it was a musical. Now, typically, I'm not a big fan of musicals. I don't mind musical music, but I like watching musicals doesn't do it for me. But when I looked into this play, it has very interesting history, and it looked interesting. So I had some friends that said come along, and I went to see it, and it was amazing. And the history is incredible. It was a play. It was done in the 50s when black people and white people were not allowed to do things together, and it's based on a true story about a boxer from Alexandria Township and his life and what happens to him and why he wasn't allowed to box and in white areas and his dreams. And it's just, I thought, a really well done production. I enjoyed the cast, I enjoyed everything about it, and it's really worth going to see. I think it's still on for a week or two. But when you look on the other side of it, there's actually an amazing Jewish history to King Kong, and we're going to be exploring that in the show today. And we have one of the original people who helped put it together, and so we've got him in the studio. His name is Lionel Slier. I'm sure you'll know him from his work in the Jewish Report, and he is a key organizer for the United Zionist Luncheon Club. If you want to go and get a bit of food and some interesting listening on a Friday afternoon, they do a great talk. I've done a talk there once or twice. And he's going to come talk to us about his role in this musical production back in the 50s. It was the 50s, right, Lionel?
1959.
Well, there you go. And if you want to ask any questions, by the way, or you're interested in any kind of this aspect, please, you can SMS us 34519, email us on air at chaifm.com, tweet us at chaifm, or you can even WhatsApp us on 0621482374. Lionel, thank you so much for joining us on the New Blue Review.
Good morning. Good morning to the listeners, and good morning to you, Benji.
So tell me, for a start, you were involved. What was your involvement with this play?
Well, let me go back a bit. There's a chap called Ian Bernhardt. I knew him from school days. And he became very involved with black music. He had a company or an organization called the Union of South African Artists. And they promoted black concerts, mostly, funny enough, the concerts were held in the Selborne Hall, which was part of the City Hall complex. And although it was in the apartheid era in the 50s, for some reason they allowed whites and blacks to go to the concerts. The concerts were brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But they were limiting, you know, they'd have a concert, it would last for 3 hours or something, and that would be the end of it. And then Ian had this idea that there was so much talent there, they could do something more, make something bigger. And it came about that there was this boxer you mentioned. His name was Ezekiel Dlamini. He was the black, note the word black, champion, heavyweight champion of South Africa. In other words, him and white boxers were not allowed to fight each other. Mm-hmm. And Dlamini had sort of reached the peak. He wanted to fight South African boxers, that wasn't allowed. He wanted to go to England, but also wasn't allowed. So he was a very frustrated person. Apparently he also had a very short temper. You know, he wasn't the nicest man on the block.
As a boxer, you might expect that he might have had a bit of a temper, right?
Well, as a boxer, it probably helped him. Anyway, there was an incident in a shebeen, they called it, in which he killed a man. Mm-hmm. There was a fight and he killed a man. And he was brought into court and he got off on self-defense. So he
said he was attacked, basically.
Yes. But then later on, he had a girlfriend, Joyce. She ran a shebeen. And he saw one night in the shebeen with another guy who was actually a member of a gang. And he fought with this other guy, and he took out a knife and stabbed this other guy to death.
Wow.
And he stood there with a knife and started shouting to everybody, "Call the police, call the police." Well, police came and arrested him, and he appeared in court. In court, he stood up and he said to the judge, obviously a white judge in those days, "Let's not waste time. Sentence me to death. I want the death sentence." And the judge, of course, ignored that. And the case went on. And eventually, Dlamini was sentenced to 12 years in jail. Hmm. And as the judge said, 12 years, he said, "I want to be hanged. I want to be hanged. I don't want to go to jail." But he did go to jail. He went to Lukop Prison, which is between Johannesburg and Pretoria. He wasn't there very long, and he drowned himself.
Wow.
So that was
it's quite a tragic story, actually.
Very tragic story. And there was a Jewish lawyer, Harry Bloom, and he wrote a book about it. Well, no, he picked up a book had been written about the story, and he wrote
like a script couple of things. Playing.
Yes, a couple of things were happening at the same time. They were the Menels, Irene and Clive Menel. They had the idea that this was a possible story which they could turn into a musical. As you say, there was this tragic element to it. So Harry Bloom wrote the book, as I say. It's exactly the script. Then Pat Williams, a Jewish girl who was a journalist, she worked for the Rand Daily Mail, which was an eminent newspaper in those days. They asked her and Todd Matsukiza to write the music, and she wrote the lyrics. It grew from then onwards. Leon Gluckman, who was the leading play director or producer in Johannesburg, in South Africa in those days, he was enrolled. He was very interested in producing this play. Arnold Dover did the dancing, the choreography. Spike Glazer was a musical director, another Jewish element.
So there were a huge number of people that were actually involved in creating this. And it's quite a fascinating. Sorry, so we're going to go a bit more into that. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk to you about some of those people involved. I want to know how you got involved. And we're going to be finding out more about the play.
Okay.
From talk to music, from Johannesburg to Israel, from sport to business, this is 101.9 High FM.
I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. Welcome back to the program. We're talking to Lionel Slier today about the musical King Kong and his involvement with it, and some of the Jewish angle that was contained in the show. So, Lionel, you were telling us a bit about some of the Jews that were involved, but this was also a crucial platform for launching a number of famous black artists. I mean, yes. Todd Matsukiza, you've mentioned already, the playwright, but also others were deeply involved with it as well.
Can I come back to that later?
Mm, sure, of course.
Let me rather get to the start, how I got involved.
Sure.
As I said, I knew Ian Bernard from school.
Right.
And he used to help produce these concerts for the Union of South African Artists. Mm-hmm. And I used to go along and help backstage. What help I gave, I don't know. Mostly I used to sell cold drinks at interval. And a tin of Coca-Cola cost sixpence in those days. So we had plenty of buyers. Anyway, when King Kong was mooted, obviously Ian Bernard wanted me, asked me to come backstage, and we got it, six of us who were working backstage. All of us were Jewish guys, all in our 20s, okay, except for the prompt was a Jewish girl. And for the 6 weeks run of the show, she never had to prompt once. Everybody knew their lines perfectly. But at the back, we had a bit of a, what should I say, a jaw. All we had to do was move scenery and get people ready for when they're going on. I mean, one was quite busy there, I must say. But the irony is that being backstage for 6 weeks, I never saw the play. We could hear it and we could hear the music, but I never actually got to see the play. Anyway, when the play opened at the University of the Witwatersrand, which had a loud multiracial, audiences, it was practically all Jewish people involved with the production. And one of the best-known people, became best-known afterwards, was Arthur Goldreich.
Yeah, he's very, very famous. Yeah. Was an anti-apartheid activist. He fought in the war for Israel's independence at some stage. Lived quite a life.
Now, Arthur Goldreich was an industrial designer, and he did all the scenery. He did the decor. He did the clothes for the audience. He designed the program and the sleeve cover of the vinyl King Kong music. Funny enough, we became quite a close group. And I'll say one thing about King Kong. There was always parties afterwards. Continuously, maybe 3-4 times a week, everybody gathered, mainly, oddly enough, in a street in Orchards called High Street, because quite a lot of left-wing, or what you might say, liberals, or communists, as they were called, lived in that street. And we used to have parties there, in which what they called European liquor was served, which was totally illegal, of course. And I was always a bit nervous that the special branch were going to barge in and arrest everybody, but it never happened.
So basically you were doing something illegal by having a party with white people and black people together.
Yeah, that's right.
It's another world.
Well, it was another world. And the special branch, or the security police, in those days used to drive in white Volkswagens, all of them. And quite often we'd go to one of these houses for a party, and there'd be one of these white Volkswagens parked outside.
Sure.
And we would think, tonight's the night. But it never happened. And I think the reason is that King Kong was such a success that the government wanted to show that they were promoting black talent.
Right.
You know, along their own lines. And so I believe that the police had instructions not to interfere.
So tell me, did you ever meet Arthur Goldreich when you were doing all of this?
Well, this is a funny thing, is that he never attended any of the parties. He would be there at the show, and he would just disappear. And everybody thought, he's so standoffish, you know, he doesn't integrate with us. Arthur Goldreich was Arthur Goldreich. And then imagine our shock when a few years later he was arrested at Lilliesleaf. It was his home and the headquarters of the ANC.
He had been hiding Mandela at that farm,
yes,
as a member and basically helped to invent and contour Sizwe using the knowledge that he had gained actually in the Israeli Independence War to create MK, which is quite a remarkable story.
I wanted to tell you a strange story about, I'm diverting for a bit. In those days, I belonged to the discussion club. It was what you'd call liberal left do-gooders. We used to meet every Saturday night in a flat in Yeovil belonging to a chap called Leon Levy. Now, Leon Levy was a trade unionist, and he was banned. So he used to leave the flat open, and we used to meet in his flat. He wasn't allowed to be there because he wasn't allowed to be in more than a group of more than three people, and especially not a so-called political group as the as we were. We were all members of the Congress of Democrats, COD. It was a member of the Congress movement. Anyway, Leon Levy was arrested, spent 90 days in jail. And at the same time when he was in jail, Arthur Goldreich and all the Lily's Leaf people were arrested. And then Leon Levy was released on condition he left the country and he went to England. Now, soon after he went to England, this Lily's Leaf arrest took place, and the Sunday Times, I believe, editor Joel Mervis, hinted, but no more than hinted, that Leon Levy had given the information to the police, which I think is absolutely blasphemous. And Leon Levy was shocked by that. And he was in England, and he really was so upset by that. And as it happened, Joel Mervis came to England, the editor of the Sunday Times, and Leon Levy went to a lawyer and said, I want to make a case against Joel Mervis, case for defamation, because he implies that I told the police about Lily's Leaf. And he said, I had no idea myself where Lily Leaf was or what it was. So the lawyer said to him, after he told him the story, the lawyer said to him, Mr. Levy, I want to tell you that in England, people are expected to help the police. So you've got no case here.
I just wanted to, we've got an SMS on the line, Lionel. It says, I went to see the show last week. Everything about the show was wonderful. From the story, the music, the dancing and the acting and the choreography, even the props were world class. What I found very disappointing was the attendance. The theatre should have been packed. Unfortunately, it wasn't. And I think a lot of it had to do with the advertising and marketing of the show. Many people I spoke to did not know that it was showing or even where, but it was simply wonderful. Regards, Helen Goldberg. Well, thank you, Helen. I think there is still time to go. So you certainly should.
It's until the 8th of October.
Okay, so you've still got a bit of time. Do yourself a favor and go see. Now, Lionel, we were talking about some of the black talent that came out of this show. Yeah. Talk to us about who was playing at the time.
Well, King Kong was played by a chap, Nathan Medelili or something. I can't pronounce his surname, if you forgive me. He was the leader of a group called the Manhattan Brothers, which were the main artists of the Union of South African Artists. So they took those four. There was a group called the Woody Woodpeckers. Four of them were there. The most prominent lady was Miriam Makeba, who was a young girl. She was in her 20s in that time, and she sang like a nightingale. Not that I think I've ever heard a nightingale sing, but I'd imagine that she did. There was
of course there was the jazz, a very good jazz contingent being the play is a very strong jazz element to the song.
Yes,
to the music. Excuse me. And of course, an early young version of Hugh Masekela was part of that as well.
Hugh Masekela was a youngster in those days. And he's gone on to be very famous. And there was Kippie Moeketsi,
yes,
who played the clarinet, and they had a nightclub named after him afterwards.
I want to talk about that, and we're going to take a short break. I hope this works. We're going to try and play the most famous track from the show. we take a short break and we're going to try and play it right now. Right, there we go. That was Back of the Moon. Sorry about the quality of it, slightly thing, but an amazing song.
Well, Back of the Moon was the name of the shebeen that Joyce, King Kong's girlfriend, ran.
Ah, okay. She was a shebeen queen.
The shebeen queen, yes. And she was the one that, should I say, he caught with the leader of the...
Tsotsis.
His name was Lucky.
Lucky. Well, there you go.
He wasn't very lucky because
he got unlucky that
he
night.
He was killed, yes.
Stephen SMSing and saying, where is the play being shown? That's at the Johannesburg Theatre,
yes,
right?
Yes, okay. In Braamfontein.
Johannesburg Theatre in Braamfontein. Stephen, till the 8th. So do yourself a favour. If you haven't seen it, definitely worth going to see.
I just want to say that they've changed it a little bit in that the original King Kong was in the original play where I was involved, was a bit of a thug, you know, he was a street fighter.
Okay.
But yeah, they've sanitized it a bit, and King Kong is a very nice guy.
He's kind of a bit of a romantic type.
Yes, you know, they've made him into a decent sort of fellow.
Was it a big thing that back then when you were doing it, that it was this all-black cast? Because, you know, And you know, there was this mixing, but the fact that it for people who were doing the production, was that a big issue?
It was a major issue. Mm-hmm. You know, suddenly all this black talent was on show there. Can I just read you some of the comments that were in the newspaper the day after the opening?
We're talking here about back in 1959?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Now, Oliver Walker was the film and theatre critic of the Star. He was really the leading critic in South Africa in those days. And he said, in 20 years of going to theatre in South Africa, this was my greatest thrill. The Sunday Express said, there's such bundles of vitality in all the acting, the dancing and the music, that you want to leap up from your seats. The Golden City Post, which was a leading black paper, said this is a milestone in the history of non-white entertainment, which it was. The Sunday Times just had two words, king size. So, really, you couldn't get tickets for the show. You could not get tickets. There used to be a place where you bought theatre tickets called Show Service. And the queue, it was in Elof Street, just off Jeppy Street, and the queue stretched from Elof Street around to the post office in Jeppy Street for people wanting to get tickets. And people used to approach me to get them tickets. I said, I've got no say.
So it was completely, you just couldn't get tickets for the thing?
Not get tickets.
And how long was the run for?
6 weeks.
6 weeks and no tickets.
And then it went around South Africa to Durban and Cape Town, and a couple of places, but Pretoria didn't allow it to be shown there.
that was too much of a...
Yeah, they couldn't handle it. But as I say, took up 6 weeks of my life, but I enjoyed every moment of it.
And were you doing it just as a volunteer for your mate, or did they pay you?
No, I didn't get paid at all, just as a volunteer, for a joll. It was a real joll.
just for the fun of it, basically.
And for the parties we had at least 3-4 times a week.
And how many people would pitch up to these parties?
Well, practically a lot of the cast.
Yeah.
A lot of the cast would pitch up. And virtually, as I say, except for Arthur Goldreich, practically all the whites involved in the front and the back.
Would come. Yeah. All right, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking again to Lionel Slier about King Kong.
Stay relevant and up to date. Keep informed. This is 101.9 High FM.
We've been talking to Lionel Slier. He was a volunteer shifting around the sets in the 50s for King Kong, and we've been talking to him about some of his experiences. Lionel, did you find that you didn't actually see the original, but I mean, what was your feeling about the new one that was playing today? And what was your I mean, given South Africa, where South Africa is at the moment, some of the racial tensions, do you think that it's a timely play in the same respect?
I would think so. You know, I've spoken to a few people who've seen this current production, and they've been very, very positive about it. They think it's very good. The music, of course, is much the same, but of course we haven't got Miriam Makeba to sing there, or the Manhattan Brothers, who were really, really top-class people. I think that that person who wrote in and said that it hasn't been promoted properly, I agree with him.
Right.
I agree with him. I mean, when we went to see it, I had to find out where it was showing. You know, it wasn't advertised that much. It's advertised a bit in the papers, but...
And when you went, did you get a chance to meet the cast and this sort of thing?
Well, what happened is that my daughter...
Who's the famous Paula Sleer.
Yes. She arranged... She had got hold of the people running the show, mm-hmm. and said to them that I was involved in 1959, and I she would like me to come backstage and meet the cast. So the show was starting at 8 o'clock, and we were there at 7:30, and she kept rushing us. I said, let's go and have a cup of coffee. No, I haven't got time. I said, the show's not even starting. No, we've got to go. So where did we go? We went backstage, and we met the producers. A lot of white people were involved in it on backstage. And I met King Kong. And actually, the Jewish Report had a photograph of me with King Kong. And very, very nice guy.
And was he excited to meet you as well?
Well, he said it's an honor. I don't know what that means.
Okay, so that must have been quite a lot of fun. And then you say that you still found the music. I personally thought that the actors looked like they were having a lot of fun on stage, like they really got into the role.
What impressed me is that there was no scene changes like we had in the original one, because the actors brought on all the props.
Right.
You know, it was part of their choreography. So I would have been unneeded, so to speak, if the production was like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought the set was quite good. Like, it's designed in such a way that you'd have to see it. But the way it's designed is quite clever, that people can, as you say, bring on things, and they do it during the songs and all that thing. Should we try play another song from because one of the aspects, of course, is the music. We recognize it now as Pansula music or sort of African kind of jazz. Yeah. I guess it must have been in its infancy back in the day, but it's a great listening. So we're going to take a short break and we'll try and play you another song from King Kong.
Connecting our community. Choose life. Choose life. The 101.9 High FM.
101.9 Chai FM. I'm Benji Shulman, and this is the New Blue Review. We've been talking to Lionel Sleer today about his role in King Kong, the musical, and its recent playing in Johannesburg. Lionel, you were saying just before, during the song actually, that was the Kwela song, that would have been played by penny whistlers. Yes. That were part of the cast.
There were six young kids. If I say young, I don't think they were more than 10 years old, mm-hmm. who were all penny whistlers, and one... The lead of them was a chap called Lemmy Special. And they had a special bus take them home every night after the show. They looked after these little kids very well, I must say. But when the show went to England in 1960, they didn't bring the penny whistlers along. You know, they couldn't take six little boys away from home. But I just want to tell you, in 1961, I was in London, yeah. and the show came on there. And I went to see the cast, or they were staying in, I won't say a hotel, but like a rooming house in Bayswater, the whole group of them. Miriam Makeba had left the show. She'd gone to America. Peggy Pango, who was in the original show, took over the part of Joyce. And I went to see some of the guys, and one took me up to their bedroom, and there were four of them sharing a bedroom, but there were only three beds. So I said, where does the fourth one sleep? So Sol Klaster, who was one of the pianists, a brilliant pianist also, he took me into the bathroom and took her down a wooden base about the size of the bath, and he put that on the bath, and he says that's where he sleeps every night. So I thought this was a bit sort of down-market-ish.
Now you mentioned Miriam Makeba. Do you have any stories about her?
Yeah. Three of us one night asked her to come to dinner with us the next evening, and she said, sure, she would. So we met at about 6:30 or so. The show starts at 8. And we went to a couple of restaurants in Round Wits University in Bromfontein. Not one of them would serve us.
Sure.
They said, we can't serve you. Eventually we found an Indian restaurant in Brixton, and the chap said, all right, I'll take you into a special room and you can have a meal there.
And that's where you ended up eating
with
dinner?
With Miriam Makeba. She was a lovely little, she was a young girl then, the same age as all of us.
It's quite astounding in some ways how far the country has come.
Yes.
But I think also you could probably still tell the story of King Kong in Alex and people would still recognize it, which is kind of shows we've got a way to go.
Yeah, you could, definitely.
And so you were involved with this Congress of Democrats and you were a bit involved. Did you carry on after that as an activist?
Well, I went to live in England. Actually, I was at the Congress of the People when they signed the Freedom Charter in Cliptown.
Wow.
It was on the Saturday and the Sunday. And I was there on the Saturday, and there were as many police there as there were spectators. But for some reason, on the Sunday, I was involved in a play, backstage, of course. Mm-hmm. And the police took the names and addresses of everybody who was there. So I escaped that. I missed out on that.
So did you move to England because you were concerned about what might happen?
Yeah. There was a sort of exodus to England in those days.
And when did you come back?
1969.
Sure. Okay.
I stayed about 10 years in England.
Well, Lionel, I'd love to actually chat to you further about those experiences and what you did there, but it's been absolutely fascinating reminiscing with you about King Kong and what you did. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about your experiences.
Well, I enjoyed it very much. Thank you for asking me.
And King Kong's still on till the 8th. Go see an amazing piece of South African history, Jewish history, at the Joburg Theatre. Well worth the money and well worth the play. Brings you to the end of the New Blue Review for today. Thank you so much for joining us. And we'll see you next week on the show. Shalom.